Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. If ever there were a need for good, competent, and timely intelligence briefings, it is this moment when we are witnessing events developing very quickly in the aftermath of the liquidation of a terrorist commander of the Quds Force in Iran by the name of Qasem Soleimani. We are pleased to have with us a man who has been closely studying his operations over the years, and indeed much of what has been happening in the Middle East, both related to Soleimani's predations and more generally. He is Matthew Brodsky. These days he is a senior fellow at the Gold Institute for International Strategy, and a man that we often consult with about matters in his portfolio, but it's rarely been more timely and needed than now. Matt Brodsky, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us. What do you make of the fact that we saw at long last Qasem Soleimani removed from the battlefield? Was it warranted in your view? And tell us a little bit about why, if you think so.
Well, this was, I think, by far the greatest news one could receive. If you're trying to take over or take out a terrorist leader, he by far was the strongest in the world. Frankly, he had an entire state backing him. If bin Laden or Baghdadi could have had the resources that were given to him, including, of course, well over $100 billion that the U.S. provided into Iran, the state, you know, they could only dream of something like this. So when we're talking about Soleimani is the second highest ranking person in the decision making hierarchy inside of Iran. He's directly responsible for arming, funding, training proxy groups in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Bahrain, Yemen, Afghanistan. He is responsible himself for the deaths of some 600 U.S. Servicemen and the wounding of over 1,000 in Iraq in the last decade. So he has been extremely active. Unlike bin Laden, who was holed up in Pakistan, wasn't moving around as much, though he still exercised a degree of control over operations, Soleimani was fronting all around the Middle East, showing up, taking selfies. He is someone who was actively engaged in ethnic cleansing campaigns throughout the region, and it's a very good thing that the U.S. took him out.
Ethnic cleansing, of course, is one of the things that he practiced. There were also attacks on Jewish centers, even in our own hemisphere, as I recall. He was also implicated in the 9/11 attacks against several thousand Americans here at home as part of the collaboration, not often noted, but the collaboration nonetheless between Iran and Saudi Arabia. This is a very dangerous individual, and as you say, he had the full backing of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the opportunity to travel largely at will around the world running these kinds of operations. Is there any question in your mind, Matt Brodsky, that he was in fact, as President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo and others have said, General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, involved in plotting additional attacks that would likely have resulted in still more American fatalities in Iraq and perhaps elsewhere?
What I've heard from many people who work in the Trump administration is that they can confirm that in the past several days, Soleimani was traveling the Middle East and coordinating further imminent large-scale attacks against U.S. diplomats and service members. This is something that the U.S. and the Trump administration had to act on. And again, even if there wasn't a imminent attack being planned, this is someone who needed to be taken out. No one could do more damage to the U.S. and our allies than him. He is operationally and in the decision-making hierarchy, this is the person that you would need to target if you want to send a really tough message to the regime in Tehran. And they were not getting the message. President Trump had been extremely patient, did not have a kinetic response after the Saudi oil field was attacked, no response after the U.S. drone was taken down over international waters. The response that the Trump administration had was to a U.S. citizen being killed in Iraq by their militias that he, of course, controls. When that happened, the response, of course, was to have these militias, these terrorist people, come attack our embassy, to have Khamenei deliver remarks that said the U.S. can do nothing. And they were so brazen about it. They so apparently did not get the message that they put Mohandas, the leader of Kataib al-Hezbollah, and Soleimani in the same place at the same time in the open, in Baghdad, next to the airport. I mean, they clearly did not get the message. They should hopefully receive this message. And that is what the idea of deterrence is, all of which gets back to the nuclear program, which we need to make sure they do not get a nuclear weapon.
We'll come to that after the break, I think, Matt. But just stay with this. We're being told by some that may not have as good sources as you do that the intelligence agencies have now, well, at least some members of the intelligence community, let me put it that way. I don't think it's anybody speaking for the community itself on the record, but some sources have said from inside the intelligence community to some journalists that the evidence that Soleimani was engaged in, you know, immediate threatening behavior was razor thin. You seem to discount that. I guess it, much as anything, it tells us something about some of the folks inside the intelligence community that they would be putting that message out at this moment, does it not?
Yeah, too many people have been infected with Trump derangement syndrome, and it colors everything they do. Now, I mean, I've been on your show many times. You know that I have my own views, and on certain things I agree with the president, on certain things I don't, and I say them. But some people apparently will forego American national security interests just to have their version of owning the president. And as I'm saying, even if those reports that they're trying to leak, that there was just razor thin evidence, which I'm told, of course, that there is. But if there isn't, it still wouldn't change the fact that taking out Soleimani was the exact right target. It had been a wonder that he had been allowed to live this long, considering all of the threats he posed to the U.S. and to our allies and the amount of blood that he had on our hands. I mean, people forget before 9/11, the terrorist group most responsible for killing Americans, the most amount of Americans, was Hezbollah, which is an Iranian-run operation. You can't get higher on the running external forces list in Iran than Qasem Soleimani.
We have to pause for just a second. Matt Brodsky, you've generously agreed to do a second segment with us. We're going to drill down a bit more on where we are now on the ground in the aftermath of all of this in Iraq, the nuclear weapons program in Iran, and the democratic response to all of this, which I'm anxious to get your thoughts on as well. All of that and more with Matt Brodsky, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting with Matthew Brodsky of the Gold Institute for International Strategy, where he is a senior fellow. This is the latest of a number of incarnations that Matt has held in various organizations in Washington, where he's brought to bear his expertise as a serious student of and now analyst about what are the vital interests of the United States in the Middle East and how they can best be served. Matt, we've been talking about the elimination of Qasem Soleimani, and I wanted to ask you about the immediate upshot of it in the aftermath of the takedown in the environs of the Baghdad airport. The government of Iraq has now apparently decided that it is going to require the removal of the 5,000 or so U.S. military personnel on the ground there now, primarily involved in anti-ISIS operations. Give us your reading on what the actual truth of all of that is and the implications.
So you had Iraq's parliament, the Council of Representatives. They got together and held a vote without the Kurds and without the Sunnis and passed a resolution. It's a non-binding resolution that's supposed to cancel their request for military aid. It's unclear whether the caretaker prime minister has the authority to actually cancel the request for our American presence there, which is from a 2014 executive agreement that they have with the United States. So this is more symbolic in nature. It was definitely done under Iranian pressure, of course. And this is how they're going to try to push the U.S. out. This is what Iran's goal has entirely been. Now, the way Iran, the leadership really wants to play this is to get the U.S. out, which then will lead to ISIS having a regrowing. And then that requires Iraq to require assistance from the outside.
Only in this case, the outside would be Iran. Just some backfill here. The Iraqi government, apparently, the elements of it that you've just described, the Shia parties, the outgoing prime minister, have been widely repudiated by the people of Iraq. The reason he is now the interim transitional prime minister is because basically the people of Iraq, not just the Sunnis, not just the Kurds, but the Shia in large numbers as well, were dead set against what was being done by this increasingly not just pro-Iran, but Iran-dominated government. And this was in evidence, it seems, just how bad the government is in how they handled giving access to the Green Zone to these Iranian militia, which resulted in their attack on our embassy last week. Talk us through all that, Matt, because it's important context, it seems to me, for what's happening on the ground at the moment.
Yeah, actually, that point can't be stressed enough. The fact is, throughout the region, and not just in Iraq, but throughout the region, Iran's image has taken a massive battering. Since October in Iraq, there have been protests against the corruption of the politicians, which is primarily a result of being under the puppet masters from Tehran. This is the actual real protest movement, which, of course, is what Iran tried to shift the narrative of when they were attacking our embassy, to portray it as these protests were about the U.S. presence as opposed to Iran and opposed to the influence that they have over the politicians there. So it's not just that the vote was taking place, as I said, and it's non-binding. It's that it's not even clear who it represents, because the entire reason that the government has been pretty much gotten rid of and we're in a caretaker phase is because the people have demanded that.
And obviously, we're going to continue to see this play out. It may result in the withdrawal of American forces. It may not, as you say. But there's going to be unquestionably further turmoil inside Iraq. There's also an announcement out of Iran that they're basically dispensing with the so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, such as what's left of it is, that with the exception of allowing the International Atomic Energy Agency to continue doing inspections of sort of Potemkin activities there, they're basically out of the bus. What are the implications of that as you see it? Does this markedly change what has been going on all along in Iran, namely their, I believe, continuing pursuit of a nuclear weapons program?
They have cheated on the agreement since the beginning. We have the evidence for that. Even the IAEA, which, frankly, can't really be trusted in this anyways, but even they have come around to the understanding of what Israel had recovered in a intelligence operation that brought out a trove of documents from Iran. They have been cheating and have been basically releasing a list of when they're going to keep scaling back their commitments to the JCPOA. This thing that they just announced is actually something that was already on their calendar and was already known, but Western media is happily doing the duty of what Iran wants, spinning the narrative the way they have it. And it doesn't change the fact that it is a very horrible development, but we should be clear that this is something that had been planned and that they had been working for. And so our response needs to be to keep the pressure on, because we're dealing with a clock that has to do with the U.S. election.
Well, it'd be interesting to see. My own feeling about this, Matt, is that there's not likely to be any negotiation worthy of the name as long as this regime is in power. But we'll see if pressure or otherwise advances that. What I'm hoping pressure will do is further incentivize the people of Iran, with whom I think we should be working assiduously to try to end this regime. That would not appear to be the sentiment of the Democrats. President Trump says, to be fair, that he's not interested in regime change either. But the Democrat response to all of this, I have to say, has been extraordinary. I worked many years ago for a Democrat by the name of Henry Scoop Jackson in the United States Senate. And I often think of the high RPMs that he must be spinning in his grave when he watches what's happening to his beloved Democratic Party these days. Joe Lieberman in the Wall Street Journal today actually pretty much denounced what the Democratic Party is doing at the moment, and it seems to me that he's absolutely right in taking them to task for a lack of bipartisanship in the face of now very direct threats against, I think, not just our people abroad, but quite possibly those here at home, according to the Department of Homeland Security, among others. Give us your read on what is happening with respect to this sort of disunity, and what, knowing what you do about the Iranians, what the likely takeaway of all of this is.
The divide in the country right now is rather amazing, whether you're talking just mainstream media, New York Times headlines, which are frankly just based on fantasy and verifiably untrue at like the click of a mouse, but they go with it. So it's something that they're clearly interested in promoting, an Iranian narrative. With Democrats, it's frankly somewhat, I mean, I guess it's not even amazing at this point, but it's certainly disturbing. The fact is, they are more pro-Iranian regime than the Iranian people are. That should give them a pause for a second, because the protests throughout the region against Iran, the protests of the Iranian people against the regime, is something that they are apparently clearly missing. And they are frankly doing the bidding of Iran. What Chris Murphy, Senator of Connecticut, has been tweeting and saying is the height of irresponsibility. And it is just frankly shameful. He's been, for them to start whining about Congress should be consulted before President Trump were to take the action. Are you kidding me? You're going to trust which of these Democrats with that information of an imminent, very specific and sensitive U.S. strike?
Matt, lastly, let me just say, the Iranians are making a lot of noise about how they are going to retaliate, and it'll be very hard, and it'll be, you know, very punishing, and so on. Knowing the regime in Tehran as you do, is it like that we will find their decision to act reinforced by this perception that this may hurt Donald Trump's presidential reelection or otherwise undermine his presidency? This is the thing that I've just been most concerned about in terms of how this this disunified face that we're presenting to the Iranians is likely to be perceived. Your thoughts on that?
That's a great point, and certainly the leaders in Iran are following developments here to see where they can widen fissures politically here, especially if it helps get rid of Trump. The way they want to, since their goal is to get the United States out of the region, they may very well focus on military targets that we have through whether it's Syria or Iraq, to try to drive the cost up so that Trump decides, I just need to get out. I mean, understand that in Syria, Iran was really hoping that the U.S. was going to withdraw from there. And in the end, we didn't. That presents them with a major challenge. They were then going to use what they were doing in Iraq, hopefully after the U.S. withdrew from Syria, because President Trump said he would then use these troops and move them to Iraq. So their goal all along is to get the U.S. military out of the region. So this is probably where they'll take the attacks out. The fact is Iran's understanding is that it can't even defeat little Satan right now, which is Israel. So they have their own rules of the game. If they know that they can't defeat Israel militarily in an all-out war, they're certainly going to fare far less well against the United States.
We'll be watching this with you, I hope, Matt Prodsky, very closely. Proxies, attacks on the military, attacks on other targets, including here at home, are all presumably on the table. It's a question of, are we deterring them? And this is where it seems to me all Americans need to stand united in trying to do that. Matt, thank you for your time today, as well as the great work you're doing at the Gold Institute for International Strategy. I hope you come back to us early and often in 2020. Thank you for your time today.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, continuing our intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, specifically the battlefront of Iran and the neighboring region. It is a subject that our next guest, Claudia Rosette, has followed over the years, as she has, well, really every trouble spot you can think of, often by being personally on the ground doing brilliant investigative reporting from such environments. We've caught up with her to talk in the immediate aftermath of the liquidation of Qasem Soleimani, and as part of our stocktaking of what comes next and what we should be doing to try to make sure it's to our satisfaction. Claudia Rosette, you have been a prize-winning journalist. You are now with the Independent Women's Forum. You are a remarkable resource, and we're very proud to welcome you to one of the first shows in 2020. Thank you for being with us, and Happy New Year, such as it is.
Thank you, Frank, and Happy New Year.
So your thoughts, first and foremost, on developments in Iran at the moment and our vital interests as they are being now shaped by the aftermath of Soleimani's demise.
I think that President Trump, in ordering the strike that killed Soleimani, did exactly the right thing. Look, apparently he and Iran were behind the storming of the U.S. embassy in Baghdad earlier in the week. That's very major. You know, remember when that happened? Well, if you don't remember, you've read about it in 1979, you know, with the Islamic Revolution. That was one of the first things that happened. Quite dangerous. And we know the record of Soleimani, and we know what was he doing in Iraq at all. He was under a UN travel ban, so he wasn't supposed to be traveling outside his country. So we now have Iran in outrage. You know, they don't just want their cake and eat it too. They want everything. Saying, on the one hand, you know, this is uncivilized, unbearable, cannot be that Soleimani was finally killed, and the U.S. finally killed Soleimani. And at the same time, they want to avail themselves of all the levers of, it's a civilized order, and we don't want, you know, you can't do this to us, we are a sovereign nation. We're hearing from critics of this action that, oh, Soleimani, he's being described over and over as a high-powered Iranian official. Well, another accurate description would be Iran's top operational terrorist. You know, but that's not what we're hearing on a lot of the news. We're just hearing, oh, high government official, as if it were now policy to just run around sort of assassinating any high government official in a country we don't like. That's not at all what's just happened.
And Claudia, you're similarly hearing that there's no strategy behind what Donald Trump has been doing vis-a-vis Iran from some of these same people. What is your reading of it in terms of what has been done, starting with arguably the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action up to the moment?
Yeah, I think, and again, I'm sort of trying to parse out because I don't have some inside line on what is the sort of full strategic intent here, assuming there is one. But I do think there's a strategy here. When President Trump inherited this whole scene from President Obama, it was a set of sort of interwoven disasters. And when we ask, what is the strategy? I think very often there's a tendency to focus on what is the strategy for Iran, as if it existed in isolation. It doesn't. It has backing from China, from Russia. And remember, we were all sort of hot on the trail of Iranian-North Korean missile and nuclear collaboration a few years ago. I would continue to worry about that greatly. So it's part of a bigger picture in which you had this sort of rising conglomerate axis, if you like, of malevolent dictatorship that have become increasingly threatening to the United States. And the question was what to do with Iran, you know, and what to do with Iran in particular. There was a nuclear deal that Obama concluded, bragged up, and left to play out that did not stop Iran from getting the bomb. I mean, the reason Iran has stuck with it as far in the ways, various ways, officially, basically, even when cheating in some ways, is because it was hugely to Iran's advantage and gave them access to enormous resources, not just the cash shipped secretly to them in the middle of the night, $1.7 billion as the deal went into effect, officially for a sham deal in The Hague and so on, but also to a lot of oil revenue, to tremendous resources, which they began using right away to expand further a very malign influence in the Middle East, including their fiddlings in Iraq, which were quite major, including the mess in Syria.
To say nothing of the $150 billion that was also thrown their way in the course of all of that. But Claudia, the point is that this is the mess that the president was handed upon coming to office, and in responding by saying, you know, we're not going to perpetuate this one-sided and very, very dangerous deal, and we are going to reestablish the maximum pressure sanctions. One of the things that seems to have been playing out of late, and I'm anxious to get your thoughts on this, Claudia, because you follow these sorts of developments so closely, is that the people of Iran have increasingly been vociferously opposing their regime, prompting some of the most brutal crackdowns on them to date. How significant is that development, and what can we be doing to intensify that pressure rather than, slacken it?
Well, I think some of this we've been doing already, because in the broader picture, what President Trump has been doing, it has been in one area after another confronting these regimes and saying, no, you can't do this. You may not do that. And I think very often, again, in the news, because he talks about them in ways, you know, I don't like. I don't like hearing Xi Jinping praised as a great guy, or North Korea or Kim Jong-un described as my best pal. On the other hand, those are words. In practice, he has been rebuilding the U.S. military. He's been pushing NATO members to actually put real skin in the game, as opposed to just hitching a welfare ride in the United States. He has been pushing China in all sorts of ways. And I think overall, the huge intractable question is, what do you do if you don't want to actually go into a hot war with one or all of these countries? What do you do? And he's been bringing a lot of pressure to bear in many ways on the ground, even if not always on his Twitter feed, okay? And I wouldn't place too much trust in sanctions. You know, we've had sanctions on Iran for decades. And with North Korea, we're forever hearing we're strengthening the sanctions, ratcheting up the sanctions. They have their uses, but they have not succeeded in either altering the behavior or bringing down these regimes to date. I think they're one more thing, but probably even more important is both beefing up the U.S. military and making it credible that this is a threat, that's how you get real deterrence. And that's where I think killing Soleimani, and the U.S. gave plenty of warnings about this, that Iran had to stop its backing of terrorism, its fomenting of trouble in Iran, its killing of, by way of IEDs and so on, of American servicemen. That says there is a red line. So what Trump has been doing is drawing as best we can, in this sort of complicated world environment, a set of red lines. And in all the discussion of, oh, have we now provoked Iran? Iran is a self-provoking Islamic revolution, okay? They've been doing that since 1979. And when they stormed our embassy early last week, where was the sort of bated breath, breathless question of, oh my God, what will the U.S. do in response? Because they've really provoked us. Instead, all we're hearing is, we've provoked Iran. What will they do? And I think one of the things they're probably doing this in North Korea and China and Russia as well right now is saying, gee, the U.S. actually will act.
Yeah, this is an incredibly important point, Claudia, and one that I was anxious to get your thoughts on as well, is how is this being perceived now? We're going to talk with Greg Scarlett in a moment about North Korea, but knowing the Kremlin, as you do, knowing the apparatus in Beijing, as you do, from your extensive reporting in both places, what is your sense of the attitude towards Donald Trump in the aftermath of this? And if you would actually address as well, to what extent does the active undermining of him in a highly partisan way actually embolden our enemies in any of those places?
Oh, I think on attitude, there are, of course, two parts to that in any of these countries. One is the official propaganda that comes out, which, the denouncing him, he's destroyed civilized order, this was unthinkable, ignoring the fact that there was a UN travel ban on Soleimani, who shouldn't have been outside of Iran anyway, right? But the other is internal. And here we have to guess. I stress, I have no inside lines to any of these places, but not to the Kremlin, not to the inner councils of the mullahs in Tehran, or the IRGC. But there has to be a considerable rethink of what can we get away with, because what limits what these countries do right now is largely what can they get away with. And there's just been a red line drawn there, where if you are concerned that if you're one of the top people in these regimes and you're concerned that your main guy in the field or you might get killed in a drone strike, or that something truly violent, irreversible, and so on, non-negotiable will happen, you're going to be more careful. It's sort of like, instead of going after the suicide bombers, there's finally been a strike on one of the masterminds behind them.
Amen. And just on the question of disunity and how that's being perceived by our adversaries?
Oh, on our disunity, I'm sure that that's something they hope to see lots more of and will look for any way to exploit. I don't buy the idea that they don't quite understand U.S. politics. I think they all study us in a huge way all the time, and we're easy to study because we make a lot of noise. We're very open.
Claudia Rosette, thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for the work you do at the Independent Women's Forum. Keep it up, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Greg Scarlett, too, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're taking stock of the world post-elimination of Qasem Soleimani, and it seems like a opportune moment to catch up with an old friend, Greg Scarlett, who is the executive director for the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. He also serves as the vice president of the executive board at the International Council on Korean Studies and is a visiting professor at Hankook University of Foreign Studies in Seoul. A man who knows his way around the Korean Peninsula. We're always glad to have him with us, and especially to take stock of how Soleimani's demise is being perceived in Pyongyang. It's good to have you back, Greg. Welcome. Happy New Year to you.
Thanks. The pleasure is always mine. How is the news of Soleimani's demise being received in North Korea? Well, what we know is that the 8th of January is the birthday of Kim Jong-un. The birthday of Kim Jong-un has not been elevated to be on par with the birthdays of the father and grandfather. On the other hand, what we know is that for the past few days, since the death of Soleimani, he has not been seen in public. North Korean propaganda mentioned that he had visited Kumsusan Palace. This is the place where they keep the embalmed bodies of his father and grandfather, but that was about it. So obviously he got the message, his regime got the message, America will no longer tolerate threats or bellicose language or behavior.
Interesting. Well, let's hope that's the correct perception and that he has, in fact, gotten that message. It comes against the backdrop, of course, in the run-up to Christmas of much talk by the regime in Pyongyang about making a present of some kind that might involve a strategic weapon. This sounded rather threatening. Did you find it surprising that we haven't seen that unveiled at this point, or what do you expect to come?
No, not at all. I had been joking about it that it doesn't make me a prophet, by the way, or a soothsayer, but I had been joking about it that perhaps the Christmas surprise would be that there would be no Christmas surprise. These are very serious matters. And the testing of nuclear weapons, the testing of ballistic missiles by North Korea has been banned and basically has been the subject, the topic of numerous UN Security Council resolutions. This is a very serious matter. There is a sanctions regime aimed at preventing the development and proliferation of North Korea nukes and missiles. If the sanctions don't work, what is the next step? The next step is very serious business, and let us hope that the regime of Kim Jong-un will get the message. But nevertheless, whether they test or not, experts agree that their work on the two programs continues and the development of the two programs continues, whether we're talking to them and whether we're not talking to them. Those developments continue.
That's really the point that I wanted to address with you, Greg, is that to the extent that we're watching Kim Jong-un continue to pursue nuclear capabilities and ballistic missile capabilities, is there really a basis for sort of taking comfort from the fact that we haven't seen tests of long-range systems, we haven't seen another nuclear detonation? Or is it your reading of it as a serious professional in these matters that they are beavering away using short-range missiles to validate technology that could be transferred to longer range ones, and I think pursuing probably in underground undetected facilities the continued production and assembly of nuclear materials and weaponry even?
Well, it's clear that the Kim regime believes that the development and possession of nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles, in particular, a long-range ballistic missile capable of reaching the continental United States, is a guarantee of its survival. And of course, the ultimate objective of this regime is its own survival at any cost, while exploiting and oppressing its own people at home and abroad. The fact that we have not seen long-range ballistic tests or nuclear tests in a while is, of course, positive, but by no means indication that the regime has abandoned the two programs. The only way to do away with North Korea's two programs is to present the regime of Kim Jong-un with a very simple choice. If survival is indeed your choice, if survival is indeed your ultimate strategic objective, the choice here is to survive and perhaps prosper if you improve your human rights situation, if you adopt reforms, if you adopt fundamental social, political, economic reforms. If you choose the other path, the path of ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, survival will not be an option. I think that this is the message that President Trump delivered to Kim Jong-un in Singapore while presenting him with that trailer, which I'm sure you recall, presenting the two options that North Korea had.
How would you respond to the, you know, sort of contention that the North Koreans and their apologists have often made that, well, Things didn't work out so well for Muammar Gaddafi when he gave up his nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction programs. On what basis would you, if you were in North Korea, Greg Scarlato, be sanguine about your prospects were those missiles and nuclear arms no longer in your arsenal?
Well, clearly the North Korean regime learned the wrong lessons from the Middle East. I'm stating the obvious. Libya and North Korea are two very different places. Sectarianism, clan, tribe play and have played a very important role in the Libyan conflict. For the better or for the worse, the Kim family regime has forged a sense of North Korean nationalism. Of course, this is a version of national communism that has been toxic, that has done a lot of harm and killed hundreds of thousands of North Korean people. But the fundamental issues that have plagued Libya since the fall of Gaddafi are not necessarily applicable to North Korea. South and North Koreans are the same nation. There is no model for a successful, prosperous, democratic, free, independent Libya. However, there is a clear formula for a prosperous, leading economic powerhouse, democratic, fully responsible state, Republic of Korea, South Korea. So the Han River miracle, the astounding economic, social, political development of South Korea has been accomplished. There are countries with a vested interest in Korean Peninsula issues. First and foremost, of course, the Republic of Korea, the United States, Japan. There are wealthy neighbors surrounding North Korea. There are models and prospects for economic development. If this regime gives up its tools of death, if it ceases to threaten South Korea, the United States, and its neighbors, if it chooses the path of human rights improvement, economic, social, political reform, the future of the people of North Korea will be bright.
That's a very promising portrait of what might happen, and I pray from your lips to God's ears. It does seem to me that Kim is probably as concerned about the South Korean model being applied to his country as any other, as that would seem to imperil the regime. Let me ask you quickly, Greg, about one other matter, because we're almost out of time and I did want to touch on it. American diplomats are reportedly responsible for helping 13 defectors from North Korea get out of Vietnam to some other destination as yet undisclosed. They avoided being sent back to North Korea, where they would have met a very, very harsh fate, needless to say. The South Korean government apparently was, well, AWOL in all of this. Very quickly, what's your reading on both what the U.S. did there, I think quite commendably, and where the South Korean government is on such matters as the repatriation of defectors from the North?
Quite honestly, I have just returned from winter break. I'm not sure if this was an entirely private effort, whether there is government involvement. I couldn't confirm that. Of course, I welcome the news if this is the case. It's wonderful that these North Korean escapees have been rescued. However, this should not be a one-time occurrence. They deserve protection under international law, under the 1951 Refugee Convention, for example.
Greg Scarlato, thank you so much for the work you do. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.